We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So, get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.
Welcome to the next edition of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone.
And I'm Brooke Daugherty.
And we are here today with a special guest, Mariam Zahr. Mariam Zahr is somebody who hasn't been here that long, but in the short time she's been in the Palisades, she has set the gold standard for community involvement. Let me tell you just a little bit about her, and then we're going to go back and talk about her background. So she's currently the chairman of the Palisades Community Council. She was the founding chair of the Palisades Task Force on Homelessness. She's the vice chairman of the Westside Regional Alliance of Councils. She was recently named Volunteer of the Year by our supervisor, Sheila Kuehl. And she was named by Mayor Eric Garcetti to the LA Commission on the Status of Women. That and many other reasons is why we've asked Mariam to be here with us. So, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. So, you have, besides all the things that you've done in the Palisades, your life started a long time ago in a place far, far away. So, tell us where you come from and a little bit about your upbringing.
So I always say I've traversed three continents to get here, and I feel like now that I'm here, maybe I have a little bit of a different perspective on life than most. But I started in Iran in the 1960s, towards the late 60s, I have to say. But I was born in Iran at a time when it was a third world country, but it was definitely on a march towards a more modern place. And I was lucky enough to be born to a family that was very educated. I had forward-thinking, modern parents who believed in education, and you know, they didn't see their daughter as being much different than their son. So, you know, I grew up in a Middle East that was a little bit different, or at least in an Iran that's different than the Iran we see in the news today. By the time, before I was 10, there was a revolution. It was an Islamic revolution that my parents were not fond of, so we left. We moved to France. We lived there.
Let me stop you there for just a minute. Tell me a little bit about your parents. What did they do for work? What was life like at home in Tehran back then?
So I'll go one generation before my parents, because my grandmother, on my mother's side, was actually one of the first three women in Iran to go to medical school. You would imagine that her kids, the next generation, was also kind of forward-thinking the way that she had been. She had one son and four daughters. So obviously her son, you know, went to school and became whatever he became, but she insisted that her four daughters also go to school. So my mother actually went to England and got a master's degree in engineering and came back to Iran and started a factory. So she was, as far as I know, she was the first woman in Iran to own a factory. So she was a businesswoman, which was rare. My dad had a doctorate degree from the Sorbonne in Paris. So he was kind of an economist. He had a doctorate in economy. He was one of the founders of the stock market in Iran. So I had not that I knew it at the time, but I probably had a remarkable Iranian upbringing.
It sounds like you had almost an international upbringing with your parents and your grandparents having traveled all over the world. And
they were pretty international. Every vacation, I remember from school, every vacation we had, we would go somewhere. So we'd go like skiing in Austria, or we did travel quite a bit. But again, I was a little kid and I didn't realize that that was a different lifestyle than most.
Was your family different than the other families that you grew up with in the neighborhood?
No. And that's what I mean. The families around us were very much the same. They were pretty much all forward-thinking people that who at least by the time I was born, had at least one generation go outside of Iran for an education and come back and try to give back to community, I guess kind of in the same way I'm doing now, but give back to their society, you know, in a selfless way. And that's all that I saw. I guess I was 10. I was 9 or 10 when the revolution happened. And it took me years, at least a decade or two, to really figure out that, you know, the country that revolted was different from the country I saw when I was growing up.
When you were growing up, what did women wear?
My Iran was secular. So the Iran before 1979 was a secular place where people looked like you and I. Women wore, well, actually, caveat, good question. Women I knew in our sphere in the major cities looked like you and I. But again, it took me decades to realize that, you know, in the rural parts of Iran, women were still covered by choice. And that was really the undercurrent that led to the revolution.
So we all know that currently Iran is governed by a religious...
Theocracy,
yes. Was religion an important part of your life growing up?
It was not an important part of our lives. And again, that might have been remarkable. Because as I grew older and I read many, many, many books about the history of Iran and even the trajectory of the revolution, I realized that religion played a huge role in people's lives. Maybe less so in the cities, but very much so in the provinces and in the rural areas. And what was weird was that, you know, there was no digital revolution. There was no email or internet. But back then, you know, if you lived in a city in the third world and you didn't seek to figure out what was going on beyond the boundaries of that city, you probably wouldn't know. So I think the revolution was a surprise to a lot of people because it seemed the undercurrent had been sort of undetected by the average person for so long.
Well, so was Islam omnipresent as you were growing up, even though you weren't dressing in the hijab and stuff like that, but was Islam an important part of the community that you were in?
In hindsight, with my adult hindsight, I'd have to say that it was. At the time, as a kid, I don't think I detected it. You know, the people, so like our cook or our driver or the people who worked in our house would show up covered, you know, with their chador, and then they would take it off during the day, and then they'd put it back on and leave. And it never occurred to me that's common. Because in our little neighborhood, everyone was secular. So again, it was kind of a bubbling up of I think what the majority. The revolution was the manifestation of how the majority lived.
How did you feel as a 9-year-old little girl, just sort of coming on to, I don't know, pre-teenagerhood, and having your whole life just change like that?
I think about that often because I'm a mom now. I'm a mother of three. And, you know, we've moved a few times in the last few years. And I think about that very often. I went to an American school in Iran. So when we left and we got to the States, I already spoke English. So maybe my adjustment wasn't as tough as other people's. And then I had cousins who were half American. So I had aunts and uncles who had married American spouses who had children, and they were half American. So, you know, my landing was probably a little bit softer than average. But as I went through, you know, even after we landed and life had changed and I went through adolescence, I was definitely odd, right? I went to a small private school in New Jersey. I was definitely more odd than the average kid. But it wasn't that difficult on me. I don't look back on those years and remember trauma, probably because my parents kept life reasonably stable. As much as I recognize now how difficult it must have been for them, you know, when the narrative at home stayed kind of constant and stable.
Did you have siblings?
I have one. I had one brother who was older. But so now when my own little family goes through changes, I worry. But then I remember that if my husband and I can keep it somewhat stable for these guys, then they can probably sail through.
Kids are pretty resilient.
Kids are. And you forget as an adult how resilient your kids can be.
So when you left, your family left Iran, did you leave in a hurry, like have to grab your stuff and pack up and get out before the gates closed? I mean,
we did leave in a hurry. So we went to an American school that that came under fire, basically. There was a protest that was actually on the street where our school was, and there was a little bit of a violent conflict. As I recall, a couple of people died, and so they closed down the gates of the school. And it was a really volatile time. There were demonstrations in the streets. It was not a calm time.
Was this before the revolution or during?
This was before. This was like the lead up to the revolution.
Right before Khomeini came back from France.
Right. Or at least a few months before.
Yeah.
So it was volatile. It definitely was. And my mom's office was downtown. And my parents were monarchists. So they supported the monarchy. And I remember as the hushed conversations kind of began at home, where my mom would say to my dad, you know, there was a grenade at a building nearby. I think it might be time for us to leave. Or my dad hushedly saying to my mom, you know, this might be the time for you and the kids to get out. I remember when it sort of began. We weren't privy to the conversations, but then it was like a hard stop. One day they said, we're leaving. And we just packed, I think, three suitcases. We're a family of four. We packed three suitcases, got on a plane, and came to Paris, where my parents owned a home, in France at least. And they said, we're just going to wait it out here for a few months until things calm down. And clearly, things never calmed down.
Did they get to go back and get your belongings? And were you able to pack up your...
No. So years later, so we landed in Paris. We stayed in a hotel for 3 months. Literally, my parents truly thought this would just be a short little stop and we'd go back. That didn't happen. Eventually, we moved out of the hotel. And then by the end of that year, I was in fifth grade. By the end of that year, they told us we were moving to the States, and we came to the States. Never looked back.
And did they just leave a lot of their belongings and possessions?
They did.
There in
the Toronto? Chronology escapes me now, but I think my dad may have gone back once and had trouble getting back out, as I recall. But that was it for like a dozen years until I graduated from college. I graduated from BU, and I really wanted to go back. By then, I understood that I had missed something.
All right. Before we get to college, I want to get you back to... You guys land in New Jersey, and you go to school, and you're like 10 years old or something like
right.
that? Okay, you were in Paris for a short time, then you come to New Jersey. And what was it like? Did you have an easy time acclimating?
I really did.
Because you spoke English?
Were the kids socially about the same because you'd been in an American school?
Yeah, so I look back on this very often because a lot of my peers, you know, Persian women in my generation who came, who did this immigration of some sort, whether it was to the States or somewhere else, you know, often talk about the trauma of that adjustment, how difficult it was. And I really try to search my brain to figure out, you know, did I miss it? Was it there? Was my trauma there? And I just somehow glazed over it. Amazingly, it wasn't. And I wonder this now as a parent. When the first year I went to school in the States, I was in sixth grade. And back then, sixth grade was still elementary school. And my parents put me in a public school. So the private school they wanted to send us to didn't start till seventh grade. So sixth grade, I had to go to a public school. And there was no adjustment. The teachers were so friendly. Administration was so friendly. There was this natural diversity in that school that I guess lent to my adjustment. But kids were wonderful. I mean, I remember my two closest friends. One of them was partially deaf. She taught me sign language. I literally could speak in sign language. And really, it was just a seamless adjustment. The next year, I did go to a private school. It was much tougher. You know, the world dwindled down a little bit. It was naturally less diverse. And I really did feel like an oddball for a few years. Now, as a parent, when I look at, you know, I guess, friction we have at home between my husband and I talking about private or public school, I often wonder if public school isn't just a better glimpse of the world they'll meet when they get older, and if that's not a better place to be.
I don't know. I mean, I went through that argument when our daughter was in fifth grade at Marquez, and we went back and forth, and we ended up at that time choosing private because their program, their base of students was so much more not only diverse but integrated within the school. There was more economic sameness, but more racial and cultural diversity, and I really, really valued that. And I noticed it at in Young Angels when we would work with kids from public schools that while you could say the population was diverse, in fact, the kids hung out with their own groups. And I mean, I think they both have their value, but I think now probably Paul Revere and Palisades, it's very different than it was 10 years ago. Everybody's gone back to public school.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm talking about a different generation and a different coast maybe. Mm-hmm. But I see it too, at least in the middle school. Like-minded kids hung out together, and even though the population was diverse, I don't know if socializing was all that diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're back, getting back to when you're in New Jersey, it was around the time of the takeover of the U.S. Embassy, right? So there was a lot of bad feelings about the Iranian revolutionaries, the Iranian government, because they were holding Americans hostage. Did any of that spill over onto you? Did people say, oh, you're Iranian, treat you differently, looking back? Because, you know, and the reason I'm asking is because nowadays, in this current ambiance, there is certainly stereotyping of countries of origin as being good and bad and things like that, without commenting on that. But I was just curious, did that impact you based upon what was going on at the time?
I can't say that my memories are absent of any of that, but it was just the beginning of Iran being this kind of rogue nation. I would assume that today, if an Iranian kid who was as awkward as I was, with the exception of speaking the language, but just generally as awkwardly looking and dressed, you know, as I was.
I can't imagine that.
I'll show you pictures. Were to emigrate today to the States, they might have a tougher time because the narrative is now so established that Iran is this rogue state. Back then, it was new. So a kid, let's say, in sixth or seventh grade maybe wasn't even hearing about it yet because it was just really a brand new, fresh narrative. Parents were hearing about it, but as I recall, the families that my parents had befriended in New Jersey seemed to be so open-minded that they seemed to understand that we were different from what they were seeing on TV. I do remember in seventh and eighth grade really swimming upstream to be normal. Being normal was something I had to attain. I wasn't quite there yet. I wasn't mainstream. And yes, the Iran hostage thing did come up a few times, but I don't remember it being horrible. I don't remember ever running home crying or going home crying or waking up and saying, I don't want to go to school.
But that was pre-social media, right?
That was. It was pre-social media. And, you know, you're a kid from an immigrant family and you have in the back of your mind this this kind of baseline that, yes, you're going to struggle a little bit and, you know, keep a stiff upper lip and struggle a little bit. And that's just how, you know, I think that's how kids who go through a tough time kind of just have that baseline. That's how you're raised, you know, sort of just grin and bear it. You're going to get through. And I hear this over and over from immigrants who end up being pretty successful. They'll look back and say, well, we just kind of went through it because we knew we had to, you know, it's different. It's different from, you know, if everything's always been kind of really easy and really great. And
what about now in the present climate for young people?
It's so much different. I cringe to answer. I think it's so much different. So my kids were born here, and I hear more from them about being Persian than I ever.
In a negative way from their peers, you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my kids are pretty well assimilated. You know, they're good kids and they're pretty well assimilated. But still, I'll hear from my son, you know, these things that even I didn't think about, you know, about ethnicity and the color of skin and where they come from. And, you know, can we or can we not be proud of our culture or our history or our heritage? I hear that a lot from him. And so I do find myself often trying to tell him about the rich history of being Persian. It's not about the country of Iran or, you know, a religious narrative. It's this history that you come from, this culture that's thousands of years old, and there's so much there for you to be proud of. You know, get beyond the aesthetics and kind of dig a little deeper.
Have you noticed as a parent in the Palisades that just through your kids, is there an undercurrent of meanness, or have you seen any kind of rise in, I don't know what the
bigotry?
Yeah, thank you. I didn't want to quite say that, but
I don't see any meanness.
Okay, good.
I don't see any meanness. I do see there is a little bit of like a joking narrative. It's almost like a satirical narrative. That again, you know, I look at some of the kids that are better, that are well adjusted and somewhat comfortable with the narrative of their history, and they kind of sail through it. And then I see some of the kids who aren't as comfortable, maybe don't come from families that are as assimilated, and they struggle with it a little bit more.
Well, one thing occurred to me is that when you came here, you came just after the Shah was overthrown, and the Shah for many years was our ally.
Right.
I mean, he was an ally of Israel and the United States and the Middle East. So, you know, for many, many decades, we viewed Iran as our, you know, as a friendly nation. And so when the theocracy took over, it was only a short period of time before you left, and people still were in a mind of thinking that Iran was our ally, but for these guys that had taken over. Whereas now we've lived with the revolution for 30-something years, and people have seen things that Americans don't care for, and they tend to, you know, paint everybody with the same brush. And, you know, I just want to comment about what you're saying about being proud of your culture, because, as you know, I was in Iran on vacation last year, and it's an amazing country. It's you get past the Ayatollahs, whose pictures are everywhere, and you get past the dress and the moral police and all that, and you talk to the person on the street, and they welcome Americans. They're happy to have Americans there, although there aren't very many. But, you know, the culture is amazing. You know, you see buildings that are 3,000-4,000 years old, and it's a shame that your kids don't have the opportunity to go back and see that and say, this is our culture, because, you know, it probably might not be safe for them to go. I don't know, as being, you know, children of people who left Iran. So,
well, it's interesting in our family, and I talk about this openly with my kids. We're a-religious. We just happen to have an a-religious family. And so when my kids talk about, all right, so just to spell it out, the narrative that comes home is terrorism. You know, oh my God, Mom, we come from a terrorist country. And I try to really say to them that, you know, this is not a family where I can tell you about a religious history that we believe in or a religious tradition that I can pass on to you. But I can tell you about a very rich culture that you're part of. And we've got to be able to get really comfortable with that, because the terrorist narrative doesn't fit you. It doesn't apply to you. It doesn't suit you. It's not who you are. It's not who I was. It's not who your grandparents were. You know, we're going to have to get comfortable with who we are without having an easy religious narrative to pass on to them. Because obviously they live in a world where most people have a religion and they're informed by that religion. We don't. And so I have to tell them that there is a tradition and a culture and a history that they have to learn about.
Well,
and
you're intellectual global citizens. I mean, their great grandparents were members of a global community. I mean, that must be very hard. Have you read a book called A Good Country by Lala Kadavi?
I've heard of it.
It is absolutely amazing, and I highly recommend it. It's the story of Orange County, La Jolla-ish Muslim family. The kid was born here, and he is in high school, and it's not the kind of high school you're talking about. It's much more divisive, mm-hmm. and he gets a bit lost, and it's fascinating.
I'd love to read it. Yeah. I read voraciously. So,
well, you would love this, Lala Kadavi.
Cool.
Yeah, let's take a break.
We'll take a brief break.
A brief break. And we'll be back with more.
A sponsor for today's show
is none other than Mr. Community Service himself, Anthony Margulis of Amalfi Estates. I've known Anthony since the beginning of his career, and all that happens with him is he keeps getting smarter. He found me my townhouse in the Highlands when I didn't even know what a Highlands was. He gives to everything like giant chunks of commission, and I've watched him grow from a young guy who just represented buyers to being one of the most important realtors in LA today. He's a dad, he's a husband, he's a mensch. I thought he'd always be on his own, but he's built a great young team over on Monument. He doesn't grow too fast, and he hires very, very carefully. Catch Anthony at 310-573-4245. And thank you, Anthony, for being one of our early supporters.
Okay, we're back with Mariam Zarr. So, Mariam, you told us that you'd gotten to New Jersey and you were in school there and did pretty well because you spoke English, having studied in Iran. Where do you go from there?
You know, we were just talking about the influence that teachers can have on kids and how so many adults look back on their lives and remember that there was one teacher along the way that really made a difference. I think for me, it was I had a quirky, truly odd-looking woman who was my English teacher who took a liking to me really at a time when I probably needed the lifeline because I was really odd. I keep saying that and you guys look at me, but, you know, a Persian kid, like, everything about us is just slightly odd. You know,
are you going to name this quirky, odd-looking teacher?
I'm not, because I think she might still be alive.
Okay, let's not.
But she was great. So, yeah, just everything about the way we dressed, the way we spoke. Like, you know, when I would meet my my friend's parents, I would shake their hand, and I had just a very formal way about me, whereas my peers didn't. So everything was really odd, and this woman embraced the odd. And I remember at the time, my outlet, my biggest outlet, just personally, was that I would write. And I didn't really know that I could write or that I would end up loving writing. I was just a kid who needed an outlet. For whatever reason, I didn't think I was going to go to my parents because I assumed they had their hands full trying to figure out their own stuff. So I started to write. And I must have confided in this woman at some point that I write. And maybe she took note of that and so watched me. But I distinctly remember at one point her coming up to me and saying, Mariam, you write well. You should be a journalist. And I was at that school for the next 3 years with this woman pounding in my head that this is what I could or should be. So, you know, when it came time to file applications for college, it was a small school. So she was in my sphere all the time. But her voice was in my head. And so that's what I did. I applied to 6 schools. And that's what you did at the time, right? You applied to 2 reaches, 2 safeties, and 2 kind of mid-ranges. I understand, as I have a daughter going into 11th grade, that you do way more than that now. So I'm not looking forward. But at the time, there were 6 schools. I applied. As I recall, I got into every school that I applied to except for one of my reaches. And so came time to talk to my parents about where I was going to go to school. And again, we were on the East Coast, so we got in the car and we drove to quite a few of the schools I had applied to. So Massachusetts, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. It was all within the Northeast Corridor and we could get there. And we did. We hit a few of them and they were all beautiful until we got to Boston. We got to Boston and my parents realized that they had some friends, some Persian friends from, you know, from the old country who lived in Boston. And that became their comfort zone. It just clicked for them. That was their comfort zone. They were going to send their youngest child, their immigrant daughter, to a place where they knew some people would watch her. And although it wasn't my first choice, I said, fine, I'll go to Boston University.
But it was their first choice.
It was their first
choice. And that overrode your first choice.
And it's funny because now I always think, note to self, talk about their first choice, not mine, you know, when it comes to my own kids.
Where would you have gone?
I would have gone to University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. It was one of my reaches. I got in, and I'm sure that that's where I would have gone.
Yeah.
But Michigan was a little too far from New Jersey, and Boston seemed great. So they bought me a car. They said, you go to Boston, come home every couple of weeks. And that's where I went. I studied journalism at Boston University with a minor, I believe, in public relations, which I loved. And by the end, by like the last year, I had taken 1 communications law class that was like drinking water. It was just so intuitive. It was so easy. While I watched everybody around me kind of struggle with the concepts, I was like, this is great. It's like being in a candy store. So I loved it. And I, you know, figured that at some point I'd go to law school. But I graduated.
And you're still single?
Yeah, I was 21.
Okay.
Very single.
Did you date in a way that American girls were dating? Or were you feeling constrained by having come from a different country?
I'm not asking for personal details.
So I'm
funny
just
because
asking.
That reminds me of all the contradictions in my life as I was growing up. So in my sophomore year, I met a young man that I really, really liked. We became friends. We would just laugh and talk together. There were actually three of us. But we would just laugh and we genuinely became friends. He was from London. I think he was born and raised in London. If he wasn't born, then he got there when he was really little. But he was Palestinian. So he identified as being Palestinian. And I knew very little about the Arab-Israeli conflict back then. I knew some, but not as much as I would come to learn over the course of the next 3 years from this kid and his friends. But he became my boyfriend just as a progression of this friendship. And I remember coming home and telling my parents that I had a boyfriend, which was bad enough.
A Palestinian
And then
boyfriend.
An Arab boyfriend. They were beside themselves. I think they were rethinking the whole Boston thing.
Yeah.
So that was my significant other for almost the entire 3 years.
I noted, which I never knew this before when I was in Iran last year, there is a very, I don't know if you call it a rivalry, but a hatred, a dislike or something between the Arabs and the Iranians.
Mm-hmm.
They
very
each
much so.
Feel the other is doesn't quite cut it, or isn't
very much
good
so.
Enough.
The Iranians see themselves as entirely distinct and apart from Arabs. You know, maybe in Islamic Iran over the course of 30 or so years, it's changed a little bit. But the Iran, a secular Iran, the Iran that I grew up in, you know, Iranians were different from Arabs. Their history was different. Their everything, their tradition was different. Even racially, they might have thought that they were different. Right. So there is no synergy there.
So you going out with an Arab was not something your parents were at all happy about?
Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
But he was a lovely kid. He still lives in London. He's married, has two kids. I mean, he was a Palestinian like I was an Iranian. You know, we both had this
global
by birth.
Right. And we both had this tradition that informed us, but we were perfectly, you know, assimilated kids who were, you know, willing to look ahead at a global citizenship like you say. But so to my parents it was just not okay.
Where'd you meet your now husband?
That's another pretty interesting story. I met him in New York City, but as a function of having gone back to Iran after I graduated. So
okay.
I graduated and...
Yeah.
You're
skipping.
Okay.
And there, I'm trying to remember. I guess it would have had to be Bush Sr. was the president at the time. Maybe
what
not.
Year was it?
I'm trying to remember. It was 1990. I'm trying to remember.
Clinton took over in 92, so Bush Sr. would have been.
It would have been Bush Sr. Yep,
yeah.
Then I'm right. And there was a little bit of a recession in Boston, as I recall. Dare I say, our governor was Dukakis, if I remember this correctly. And there was a little bit of a recession in Boston. Here I was, having graduated, you know, with what I thought was a marketable degree. And the best I could do was become a receptionist at like a, you know, at a video production company, which I did for a little while. And I thought, you know what, this isn't it for me. I'm going to go back to Iran and see what it was that I had left behind. You know, what it was that I had missed all these years, you know, that led to a revolution that I never understood. I'm going to go back. By then, I had largely forgotten how to speak Farsi. And I certainly had never lived a life where I had been covered with hijab. I wouldn't have known how. But still, I was curious, and I just really wanted to go back. So I convinced my parents to let me go back, which was difficult enough on its own. And I remember, you know, the day I sat on the plane and said goodbye to my dad and headed to Iran. And it was a crazy time. I became a correspondent. I lived there for 4 years. I noted how much the general population still welcomed an American perspective. There were so many instances where I hate to say this, but it's true. There were so many instances where, as a normal Iranian girl, I probably would have gotten into a lot of trouble. But for my ability to maybe suddenly break into English or pretend I had an accent and I didn't understand, or even once producing an American driver's license, that I was able to get myself, cajole myself out of trouble. So it emboldened me, I think. It gave me a sense that these laws don't apply to me and that I can do my thing here.
But you still were mindful of the clothing protocols.
I very much was increasingly so through the years. The first few years I would get caught on the streets by, you know, it's called comité, but it's like the social police. You know, I would get called, and a couple of times I was actually hauled into a bus that takes you downtown so they can talk to you about your hijab, and I was able to cajole my way out. But, you know, as the years went by, I learned that the better I cover, the more I can get done, the less I'll be impeded. And so I had that down. I always say being in Iran was like being a big fish in a small sea, mm-hmm. whereas being in the States at that time with nothing but a bachelor's degree was being a small fish in a big sea. And I was really able to knock on pretty much every door I wanted to and be able to walk in and do what it was that I had set out to do. So I started out as an advertising executive. My biggest clients were Unilever, Kodak, which was Philip Morris, right? So it was Marlboro. People still smoked back then. And Kodak. I did great. I was named one of the most influential female advertising executives in Iran 1 year. I would travel to Dubai and back for this work that I was doing as a 22 or 23 year old in Iran with really no experience, but a good deal of inspiration.
And you were able to carry out your job as a professional without being too intimidated by the government.
Yes, I was, but
moral police.
Yes, but I think that was a function of the emboldenment that I had. Yeah. Exactly. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, the day I feel like these laws apply to me will be the day I'll have to leave. And that day did come. It did come. It took 4 years. And then I parlayed that advertising into new contacts and connections. I became a correspondent. I started to write for two magazines that were published in London. So in Iran, you can't really start anything. Well, so, and then eventually a daily newspaper was launched that was in English. It was an English language daily newspaper because at the time that I went to Iran, it was shortly after the war with Iraq and multinational money was coming in. So foreign investment was coming into Iran. Americans and foreigners were coming in. So a newspaper in English actually had a market. And I remember literally knocking on the door, walking in and saying, I can speak English. Do you need an editor? And being told, yes, in fact, we do. There's your desk. So I became a de facto journalist. And I lived in Iran for 4 years, and they were the most interesting 4 years of my life.
Did you have girlfriends? Did you have other young American women?
It was the beginning of expatriates, as we call them, expats, coming into Iran. So there were... you know, a couple of handfuls of people who had grown up abroad and were coming back. Not a huge number at the time. And I would meet some, and we did have a baseline in common. But I was different.
You must have still had some family that was there. I mean, extended family or no?
I probably did. You're right. My immediate family wasn't there. I did have extended family, but I don't recall having too much contact with them. I was just really thirsty to learn about Iran. I had a little car. My friends used to call it my phone kiosk. It was a little orange car. It was a locally made, like, tin can with wheels on it, and it happened to be orange. And I would zip around with this thing, and people used to call it my phone kiosk. And I just wanted to see the country. I wasn't, as a single woman, you're not really allowed to, like, drive around, but I would, and I would, you know, talk my way out of situations that I was getting in trouble for. If they would stop me at a checkpoint, I would, like, you know, literally talk my way out of it and keep going. And I really found it to be a very interesting time. I did get in a major car accident with my phone kiosk once, and so that put me out of commission for a little while.
So... you're there for 4 years, so that would have taken you up to, what, 96, something like that?
That yeah, range. 95. Okay. I came back to the States, and that's where I met my husband.
Okay. How did that come about?
So I started writing in Iran. So one day I was sitting at the newspaper doing my little editing work, and at the time there was still no internet. So what we had was a hookup to these various news feeds. So Reuters would come in, the Associated Press would come in, Itar Tass would come in, and we would take little bits and pieces of this news that was coming in, and we'd piece it together. I mean, that was what the editor was supposed to do. We'd piece it together with whatever information we had locally, and it would be then a new story. And so I loved this work. So I would sit at my desk and I would just be clicking away and checking all this stuff until one day this guy walks in. He sits like three desks in front of me. And at one point he screams, "Eureka!" And I'm like, who in this room speaks that way?
Uses
so
that word.
I look up, you know, finally noticing my surroundings. And here's this guy like three desks in front of me who says, "I'm an American and I live in Iran." And I was like, you're kidding me. How many Americans live in Iran? So he introduced me to this organization that put out a newsletter called the Iran Business Monitor. And this newsletter was uniquely for the oil and gas industry to kind of attract energy investments back into Iran. So I reached out to them, to the Iran Business Monitor. They were in New York. And I said, well, here I am. I'm in Iran and I speak English and I can write for you. So they brought me on board. Like I said, they were in New York. And months later, I said, you know what? I'd like to come out and meet who it is that I'm writing for. And when I came out here, I met the whole crew. And one of them ended up being my husband.
So you met him in New York?
I met him in New York.
On a business trip?
On a business trip. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then how did you end up in the West Coast?
So I left Iran about 4 years later when I realized that it was time for me to go. I moved to New York, where I married this guy roughly 2 months later.
Did your parents like him?
No. So my parents didn't even meet him. Because at the time, my parents were no longer on the East Coast. My mom had gone back to Iran to try to get her stuff back, her factory and whatever. So nobody was on the East Coast to meet him. So I remember calling them and saying, I've met this man and I'm going to marry him. And they were like, but you can't. We don't know him. And I said, well, you're not marrying him. Why do you need to know him? You've got to take my word for this. So we effectively eloped, which is an interesting story on its own.
He's Iranian also.
He is Iranian. He had spent years in Italy and then ended up in Massachusetts around the same time I had been there. So we had some common friends, which really was the beginning of how our friendship began. And then one day I told him, I said, you have to marry me. And he said, well, why do I have to marry you? And I said, well, because we're both Persian and we can't just keep dating. You have to marry me. And he said, I thought you were the one that had grown up here. So I said, you know, I was like, this is it. You've got to marry me. So we were married at the Iranian mission to the United Nations, which was strange enough. And then we started a business in New York City, worked very hard for a few years, did reasonably well.
Was this the handbag business?
Mm-hmm. And then...
So you were involved in that too?
I was involved for a little while.
Okay.
Does the handbag business have a name?
It did. At the time, we had six stores in New York City. They were called Alexander Czar, and they did reasonably well. Most people say, that rings a bell.
Yeah, that does ring a bell.
Is Alexander your husband's
name?
And
Alexander Czar happens to be my
husband.
Don't
call him this guy anymore.
No.
You call him Alexander? Okay.
Well, that's an odd question. That's an odd one on its own.
No, because so you said this guy. Earlier you said this guy.
So he, you know, he was born with a different name. He was born with a cumbersome Persian name.
Got it.
That he changed over the years to make it easier for him. So I call him by his Farsi name. Right, because I know him as my Persian husband. But when I started law school, one summer I had an internship and his company had a lawsuit. So the lawyer I worked for was his attorney. So I remember every time I would get on the phone with this guy who happened to be the client of the firm, I would say, hello, Mr. Czar, and I would have this conversation with him and then I would say goodbye. And I remember once one of the guys in the office coming up to me and saying, do you call your husband Mr. Czar because you have to? I think there was an assumption that, and I was like, no, I just, you know, figure I'll have some respect for like the attorney-client relationship that's going on here. So I refer to him as Mr. Czar. I don't do that at home.
Yeah, you don't call him Yay Babe. I mean, that's not how you conduct a telephone conference.
Exactly. And it was funny because I realized that was a stereotype.
Like, this employee was
this
thinking,
woman must, you know, see her. There must be that power play in their
Persian women call their husbands Mr. at home and dinner table and all that.
Right after you bring the donkeys in and feed them.
Exactly. Right, yeah. Exactly.
So how does that, so you start this business, or your husband starts this
business?
Yeah. And that was interesting in and of itself. So it was like 19, what would it have been? 95-ish?
Yeah.
95. There had been an executive order banning oil and gas investments into Iran. Not least because of a story that was broken in the newspaper that I had been working for. But in any event, there had been this executive order, and suddenly my husband and I found ourselves in the middle of New York City with nothing to do, because what he was doing was attracting foreign investments into Iran for natural gas and for oil and gas, and he couldn't do that anymore. So literally, we were walking up Third Avenue one day thinking, what are we going to do with ourselves now? And we saw a for rent sign. And I said, well, we can rent a store and start a retail business. And that's how easy it was in 1995 to start a business. We took down the number, called the guy. He happened to be this you know, old school New Yorker who had a storefront to rent. We went and met with him, you know, sort of cajoled an agreement. We had no credit, no work history. We wouldn't be able to do that today. That was just the way that it was. So we scored a store on 75th and 3rd, and then he had his connections in Italy because he had spent years there. We flew to Florence, filled the store with stuff, and the next day we opened the door and we were doing great. So within a few years, we literally had 5 stores across Manhattan.
Wow.
And what happened to those? How come you're not still there?
Well, I decided I wanted to go to law school. He was very, very supportive of that. My brother lived in California. We would come and visit. Every time we came here, we would sort of take in the view and, you know, realize that there are no sirens screaming into our ears. And, you know, one day he said, why don't you go to law school in California and we'll move. We'll sell this business and we'll move. I was like, sure. And that's how it happened. That's how we ended up here.
And, of course, you're at Pepperdine. You end up at Pepperdine with this incredible view from the law school.
Right. With Kenneth Starr.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story.
How was that? Well, let's say, compare it to your sixth grade experience. Was it more or less comfortable?
So I was older. Luckily, I was more able to spin different ideologies. But I did spend 3 years learning that there are two sides to every coin, for sure. You know, that ideologies can be completely divergent, but defensible from their own point of view. I had one amazing professor who actually is sometimes a guest on NPR, Douglas Kamek. He was my constitutional law professor. He was a very smart and very articulate man, but his politics were, you know, were
very
opposite mine.
Very right-wing.
Right. So it was interesting to listen to him because I was the student, and of course I was learning from him, so I there was no arguing. I was learning what he was teaching. But in my mind, there would constantly be this little voice that was sort of arguing against what he was arguing. And that was actually kind of very interesting.
And the interesting thing about him is that he was later appointed as an ambassador by President Obama.
Yes, and I remember that, and I remember thinking credit to both of them. But to some degree, credit to Kamek for being able to transcend, you know, the ideological boundaries that sometimes you expect people not to be able to transcend.
Right. And I taught there. I still teach there. But
oh, that's right.
For many years. And I met Ken Starr on many occasions. He's a very pleasant guy, very warm and hospitable. We didn't agree on everything that he had done in the past and all that. But as a administrator, he was friendly and, you know, did a lot for the school and brought a lot of publicity to the school recognition. So,
and I wonder if that is the trajectory of partisanship, is that, you know, it seems like partisanship is getting more and more intense as the years go by. So if you look at partisan arguments a generation ago, they seem a little more mild than they do now.
Polite.
Yeah.
There's a dearth of manners.
Oh. Absolutely. Manners. That isn't there now. And, you know, increasingly last year after year. So,
yeah, it's things have gotten, whether regardless of which side you're on, I think we'd all agree things have gotten pretty ugly.
Yeah. People seem much more entrenched.
Let's take a brief break, and we'll be back with Mariam Zahr in just a minute. Okay, so Mariam, you finish at Pepperdine Law School. Where do you go from there?
So the summer I graduated from law school, I had my first child. Not well-timed, as you can guess. Not well-timed.
Just in time to study for the bar.
Exactly. And at the same time, my closest friend from BU, from Boston, who grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, and had really this global life, married a Belgian count in Monaco.
Wow.
And she said, Mariam, you have to be my ring bearer. So it was literally the choice between being a ring bearer to a Belgian count in Monaco or studying for the bar in a library.
What did you choose?
I chose the former.
Okay.
So off we went. I went home and I said, honey, you know, believe me, trust me, I'll take the bar. I swear to you, I will. But we have this opportunity to go to, you know, to Michelle's wedding, and it's going to be great. And it's overlooking, you know, the Mediterranean, and it's in Monaco. We've got to go. And I'm the ring bearer. How is she going to get married without me being there? We've got to go. So sure enough, I pushed aside the bar, got on a plane, and went and had a really great time. But then came back to a little baby at home and, you know, at the time, still a thriving business that we had started again when we had gotten to California. And so the bar kind of just got pushed back. And then I had another child and I got involved in school and, you know,
Sense that the bar never got addressed.
It never got done. It just kept pushing back. And I remember as a kid hearing this saying that for some reason stayed with me as a child, even though it was inapplicable to my life at the time, but sort of, you know, unfolding to be truth. And it was that life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. So here I was constantly trying to circle back to this moment in time where everything would be, you know, where I would live in a vacuum and everything would go back to, you know, what it was like when I was 22 and I really had nothing to do and no one to answer to and I was just going to take the bar. And it never happened. I had two kids and I had my parents nearby and my husband and a business and all this stuff kept coming at me. And so never took the bar. But I did end up with three kids whose schools I became reasonably involved in. And a few years ago, Paul Revere appointed me to be their rep to the PPCC when it was their time to be the primary educational rep. And so that was how I ended up on the PPCC.
For some people that don't know, she's referring to the Pacific Palisades Community Council. So, yes, I was on the council for a short few years, and you were not, and I left for various reasons. And you had not been on, and the next thing I know, 2-3 years later, you're the president. And I didn't know who the heck you were, and I started finding out and reading about you. So the first thing I read about you was the Task Force on Homelessness and right. How you got involved in that. Tell us a little bit about it, would you?
So when I started on the PPCC, we had just moved to Pacific Palisades. But even before that, for years and years, we had lived in Brentwood, which is a stone's throw from here. So kids, AYSO was up here. Ballet classes were up here. Tutoring was up here. Ice cream was up here. There were a lot of reasons why I would come up here. And through the years, I had always noticed the little bit of homelessness there was around the village. In fact, I came to know one of the homeless people that had stuck in my memory from years before. He's since passed away. But, you know, it was funny because years later I got to know his name and I got to know his story. And I thought, how strange that I remember him from years and years ago when we were walking down the street and he approached my daughter. So when I got to the PPCC, there was a discussion about how homelessness had grown in Pacific Palisades. And I was not unfamiliar with that discussion because through the years of having come up here, I had noticed that landscape changing. The person who was really, or at least when I got there, and I know a lot had been done before I got to the PPCC. I know Janet Turner and Barbara Cohen had been instrumental in pushing the conversation about homelessness, and I know that Chris Spitz had been really interested. But when I got there, The person who was really leading the charge was Stephanie Cohen from Assemblymember Bloom's office. And she and I connected sort of immediately. And as she was kind of advocating at the PPCC to start this task force to deal with homelessness, she suggested that I might function well as chair. And at the time, I really had no preconception about what my time on the PPCC would look like or what dealing with homelessness would be like. But I was fine taking on the role of chair, and I was eager to see what we could do. You know, I've spent my whole life being a humanitarian, really, at base. I have a byline at the Huffington Post, and if you read the little bio, it says humanitarian. I think that's the first word. You know, that's all I was, and I have a byline at the Huffington Post because I founded an organization called Women Found, whose mission was to either raise money or advocate for the issues of women in the Middle East, and try to bring awareness to some of their struggles, which are a little bit more elemental than the struggles of women in the Western world.
Sure.
So I thought, you know, I can do this. Homelessness is something I feel for, and this will be great. So I became the chair. There were a few other people at the table who were interested in the issue. So we were a group of, I think, six when we started, six or seven. I was the chair, and then we had a number of subcommittee heads, and we each fanned out, to figure out how best you could deal with a small community with homelessness, a small community with resources grappling with homelessness. And so to the credit of Doug McCormick, who is the current president of the task force, he kind of went out to other cities, similarly situated cities, to try to figure out what they do. And his model was, let's find a service provider that can help us. And then at the same time, I started to craft our relationships with LAPD and with the city to see what kind of help we could get from them. So we brought these two elements together into really what the strategy is even now, which was to raise money from the community to be able to engage services for these people so that we can offer them an option other than homelessness. And then at the same time, to convince the city to give us a little bit more robust enforcement, while recognizing that we were also trying to get these people services and trying to transition them out of homelessness.
Not just arrest them.
Right. So we weren't just going to the city and saying, give us more police because we're asking for it. But look, we've got this strategy and we think it's going to work. Can you help us? And in fact, they did. And I was really able to craft these relationships with city and state and county agencies that helped helped us be able to implement our strategy, and the strategy has worked. And they're, you know, the task force is still doing it, and they've been very, very successful. In fact, I think they're going to release their homeless statistics in the next couple of days, and you'll see that over the course of the last couple of years, really largely as a result of the efforts of the task force, homelessness in Pacific Palisades has decreased by about 50%. So it has worked. And then we, you know, the Palisade, our little task force got a lot of notoriety because we were having a positive impact on homelessness. And so, you know, other cities started to take note of what we were doing and wondered. I think a lot of them looked kind of inward to see if they could implement the same strategy. It has proven not to be as easy. I think in the Palisades, it was a unique compilation of the people who came together and really worked hard towards this goal that we thought was important. It wasn't just talk. It wasn't just a conceptual sort of ideal, but it was this problem that we were really going to try to impact. And that kind of commitment, that kind of put your head down and do the work that needs to be done, just isn't all that common. And, you know, as far as I know, it hasn't been reproduced anywhere else.
How much did you have to raise from the community to pay for the dedicated service provider?
So our agreement with what was then OPCC was $125,000 a year, which is a great deal. No matter how I sliced it in my head, I thought, you know, what a wonderful opportunity. So it was $125,000 for us to get two full-time service workers. So full-time, Monday through Friday, every day, they would be dedicated only to the Palisades.
Where did they?
And they would bring with them all of the resources of the OPCC, right? So the mental health assistance, all of the interim housing, all the resources that the OPCC had to give. which really was huge.
So would they come out and you'd show them where some homeless people were, and they'd go talk to them and try and get them out of the canyons or wherever they were sleeping and get them into a place that they could have a roof over their heads and food.
The beginning, the start was January of 2016? Yeah, it had to be. So January 2016 was when we started. You know, it was their first day in Pacific Palisades, and that's exactly what it was. They were going to drive into the Palisades every day and go looking for homeless people and start to talk to them. And what they had prepared us for was that people aren't just going to say, oh yeah, this is great, let's go. There was going to be some resistance. So the task force got together. There were like five or six of us. We sat around a table down at Patrick's Roadhouse, and we said we would present to them a list of 20. So we would give them our 20 priorities, and we would give them locations and a little bit of history to the extent that we as a collective town knew about it. And that would give them their start. They would know where to go. They would know where to find these guys. They'd know their names. They'd know a little bit of history, and that would be their starting conversation. And that's exactly what happened.
So for communities that aren't as well-resourced as the Palisades, what would your recommendation be for them to achieve a similar sort of ratio of service to homeless people?
So when we first started, that first year when we started to raise money, we relied a lot on Palisadians, singular Palisadians, to come through for us, right? So we had an online fundraising platform. We would email. We had a newsletter. Whatever way we could, we were trying to reach out to Palisadians.
And you raised $120,000 from
donations. Today, they've done well over that. Today, they've raised a little over $500,000. And that's kind of what I want to say. You know, the last few months, most of the money that's raised, and credit to the fundraising chair, who's a Palisadian, Barbara Overland, over the course of the last year or so, definitely the last few months, the last few tranches of money that have come in from organizations, right? So it's the track record of a couple of years of having done the right thing, and now organizations are taking note, and money's coming in bigger chunks, right? When we started, it was singular Palisadians, and that was really a narrative that we had to weave and put it out through the newspapers or through our own social media to convince people that, look, we have a strategy, give it a chance, this is going to work, support us. And that first year of raising $125,000 was much harder than, you know, as we kind of picked up the clip and started to get going. The person who helped us, I'd say, the most that first year was Anthony Margulis.
Our sponsor, Anthony Margulis, yes. From Amalfi Estates.
Yes, exactly.
Coincidentally.
Exactly. He really believed in what we were trying to do. At the time, we had no track record, so it was really just on faith. And, you know, having read a little bit about what we were trying to do and believing that this was at least worth a try. So he gave us a pretty good donation. I think what he does is that he normally gives a donation, a percentage of the commission of a sale. He usually donates to an organization, and so he chose ours. And at the same time, he set up for us our giving donations, our digital donation page, and that really gave us a boost. The rest of it was just the local newspapers being willing to, you know, carry my letters or cover us, or, you know, we had monthly events where we would invite the community and we would talk about the different aspects of homelessness or what we were doing. And, you know, it was really a communications effort to try to get out the word and make people understand that although this is uncomfortable, we have a strategy and it just might work.
Well, you've done a great job.
Makes me proud of our community to know that you could go out and raise that kind of money from voluntary donations from just ordinary citizens. So you're still the president of the community council.
I just got my second term.
You are...
which will be my last.
President of the Paul Revere Middle School. You were raising children. You have a husband. How do you juggle it all?
Well, it's funny because I think I'm looking for a couple other things to do. I don't really do that great. I'm sure there's a ball I drop here and there. I'm sure there are things I don't get to. I'm sure there are things I'm late to do. I'm sure there are times when my kids are saying, Mom, and I'm busy writing an email. But I feel like this is kind of the modern world I want to say woman, but probably anyone. We're all kind of multitasking. We've got all these balls in the air, and we're doing our best to keep them there and not let anybody down. And that's kind of where I am. There are days when I think I'm completely useless, and there are days when I think, hey, that was a good day. And I assume that's the way it's going to be for a few years until my kids get a little older and I can kind of look back. But right now I'm in the thick of it, and every day is, you know, is chock full of stuff to do. And like I said, some stuff probably drops off the plate. And, I'm hoping by the time I'm 80, I can look back and, you know, be able to say that I did something productive. What I desperately like to do is get back to Women Found. I'd really like to get back to writing and advocacy and seeing if I can, you know, change the game for women again in the third world, where they really do face struggles that are entirely unfamiliar to us here in the West. So I think, you know, that's ultimately my goal, and hopefully that's where all these different paths are going to lead me.
I think you'll find a way.
Thank you. You're very kind.
This brings us to the end. Mariam, it was a pleasure for me, even though we're friends, to be able to learn more about your background and all that you've done with your life, and I look forward to hearing about more and more accomplishments. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we also want to thank Nick Grandchamp, the manager at Wells Fargo Bank, who's let us broadcast from his beautiful bank on Sunset.
Thank you, Nick.
And with that,
we're out.
We're done.
Young Angels Network out.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.